It's Wednesday, June the 2nd, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan, joined today by Harry McGee and Jennifer Bray from our political staff. You're both very welcome. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be discussing the impending Dublin Bay South by-election. But first, Harry, you were at yesterday's press conference in which the government laid out its plans for the next year or so in terms of emerging from the recession and financial implications of that.
That's right, Hugh, and it's a €4 billion plan, including €3 billion of exchequer funding and then almost €1 billion in funding from the EU. And essentially, the bulk of the money is going to really go towards continuing employment support. So the employment wage supplement scheme, which essentially gets the state to pay employers to keep their employees on the payroll, will continue until the end of the year, at least, and might continue even in some form right into 2022. And it's a costly item. It's going to cost €2 billion this year, but there are 300,000 people who are receiving their wages courtesy of the state rather than from their employer. And the government thinks that it's critical in terms of a recovery. Pascal Donoghue, I thought, was interesting yesterday. He said that there's definitely going to be a rebound during the summer, and everybody's been talking about this pent-up demand. And I think once the Sluice Gate is opened, we'll have a very busy summer in terms of people spending cash that they've saved up on holidays, on retail, and on other things. And we'll see a return of a lot of sectors that have been shuttered for a period of time. But the concern in government is that a rebound does not make a recovery, and that once that rebound comes to an end in autumn, that there might be difficulty in sustaining it and making it into a fully fledged recovery. And employment is really high at the moment. There are over 300,000 people still on the PUP. There are 170,000 additional people who are receiving unemployment benefit of one kind or another. So they have to get those numbers down. And their hope is that next year, 2022, that employment will fall to between 8 and 10% of the overall employment situation. If they get that, they'll be relatively well placed to ensure that the economy recovers. If they don't get that, they're going to be in the soup, as it were, politically. So there are a couple of controversial elements to what was announced yesterday. PUP has been tapered out. There's going to be incremental drops of €50 in September, November, and then finally in February 2022. That caused ructions with the opposition, who said there'll be a lot of people who still don't really have jobs to go back to, who are completely dependent on PUP and will be left dangling essentially by the government. So that is a bone of contention. I think Sinn Féin and the Social Democrats in particular, as well as Labour, will be pummeling that point home in the coming weeks. There's also a very big green element to this package. It's almost €1 billion, or it's over 500,000 of the €1 billion from the EU. And a lot of that money will be going into retrofitting and into this new suburban train system in Cork. So you're going to get jobs out of that. You're going to get a lot of retraining, because I'd say about 100,000 of the people who are on PUP won't really have any jobs to go to. So they're the people who will be targeted by government for retraining. So it's a big and ambitious plan. And it's the ace that the government has, really, that it's laying on the table in the hopes that the economy can recover on the back of it.
Yeah, it's interesting, John, isn't it? I mean, we look at countries that are a little bit further ahead of us on the reopening front, the United States, and to some extent the United Kingdom as well. And we are seeing that bounce, that economic bounce, which Pascal Donoghue is anticipating. I know it. I look around my suburb that I live in Dublin, and every second house seems to be having some kind of minor renovation happening, an extension built or the roof being lifted. There's white vans and trucks everywhere. But then alongside that, there are shops on our main shopping streets that are never going to reopen, and there are other businesses that will suffer such scarring that those jobs aren't there anymore. So there's a kind of there's a fine balance between treating those two quite different parts of the economy and getting through to whatever the next year may bring.
Yeah, I think there is. And I think what you're talking about there highlights the sort of the growing and very deep inequality that I think will only be more entrenched over the next couple of years as we move out of the pandemic. And we see some, certain sectors that will, like you use the word, scarred, Beascard, shops that may not reopen, businesses that will remain closed. And I suppose if you look at the level of youth unemployment as well, it is really still staggeringly high. And I think that there is this story really of the pandemic. You know, you're talking about looking out the window and seeing people who are getting their house done up, or, you know, there are people who held on to their jobs and you know, did okay. So there's this two tails to the pandemic, really. And when the government talks about tapering off supports and moving out of the pandemic, and, you know, the truth is really they cannot give any such certainties about that, because, as we know, this virus has a way of kind of being very unpredictable, of surprising us the most. And I'm thinking now particularly of these different variants. And I know they've renamed the variant, and we've got the Indian variant and the Delta variant and all this now. But I think that even within government circles, even within cabinet, there is an awareness that this is the plan that they would like to see happen. They would like to see that we move out the other side of the pandemic and we can taper off these supports, because obviously it's not feasible to continue them for as long as we have. I mean, you've just the numbers are eye-watering, really. I think Pat had an interesting line in his column the other day saying, you know, these figures would have been absolutely unthinkable just before this pandemic, and now it just is, you know, in the drop of a pan in the middle of a week. So it'll be really interesting to see how the government addresses those deep inequalities, and I'd be really interested to see how they tackle youth unemployment, even though obviously their hope is that as we move towards the end of the year and those remaining sectors reopen, that more and more people come off the pandemic unemployment payment and transition then onto the job seekers payment. It's what happens then, I think, to those industries that are scarred, which will be interesting.
And then against the backdrop of this, we're going to have a by-election, the first by-election of this particular dull term. Harry, I'm going to go to you for a sec because you live there and you have a lot of expertise on Dublin Bay South. But Jen, can I ask you first, it's happening pretty quickly. Following the resignation of Owen Murphy and his retirement from politics. It used to be that governments liked to long finger elections for as long as possible. And in fact, they did that to ridiculous extents about 10 years or so ago, until I think a court case by Piers Doherty and Sinn Féin forced an election in Donegal. Now they're constrained to some extent, but it's interesting that they could have put this off till the autumn, but they've decided to go for it early.
Yeah, they could have, and they haven't. I mean, the simplest explanation is that it is just better to get this done, you know, for a whole variety of reasons. But also, you would have to wonder, are they considering perhaps, you know, if you look towards July, and what it's looking like now is that perhaps the writ will be moved next week, and that would give you a polling date, I would presume, somewhere around the 8th of July, somewhere around that ballpark. And that will be the exact time that the government are expecting to really come into this part of their stride in relation to the vaccination campaign. If you look over to the UK, Boris Johnson went from being zero to hero, effectively. You know, his handling of the pandemic at the start was woeful. And then now it seems he can do no wrong, even when really shocking things come out about how he handled it. And I think that I do believe there is a hope in government. And I was talking to some people in government yesterday about this, that they'll get to a stage in July where that will be their big selling point, that they have got 2.5 million people fully vaccinated in July, and maybe more. And, you know, remains to be seen whether that bounce will actually materialise or not. I have my doubts, if I'm being honest, because I do think that the by-election, you know, it's not like a general election, obviously, but I do think housing, even if it's not the number one issue in every house in Dublin Bay South, the opposition will make it the issue. Sinn Féin will make it the issue. So, you know, I'm not so sure if the vaccine dividend will hold up, but I think that's part of their reasoning anyway.
So let's talk about, Harry, about Dublin Bay South. It can be oversimplified what it is. It's quite an interesting constituency. It's quite a complicated one. It covers multitudes. It is a Fine Gael stronghold. It's also one of the most socially liberal constituencies in the country. Interestingly, it traditionally has quite a low turnout in elections, and there may be specific reasons about the number of people who live in rented accommodation there. So there's quite a lot going on there, and some of those things offer opportunities to different parties or different candidates.
Yeah, it's often portrayed as a blue constituency, as a very Fine Gael constituency, and there's no doubt that it has some of the most affluent pockets in the country, Dublin 4 and Dublin 6 mansions, and there are areas of the constituency which are very rich indeed, and they have traditionally being Fine Gael strongholds. But it's a mixed constituency, as you say, Hugh. Geographically, it extends from the Liffey in the north as far as River Dodder in the south and goes from the sea at Sandymount over as far as Harles Cross, parts of Harles Cross and parts of Terenure as well. And it takes in the city centre, of course, and the city centre has become a place of residence in recent years. The demographic is interesting. It's a young constituency, a lot of people under the age of 40. It has one of the highest percentage of rented, private rented accommodation in the state. Almost 50% of those who are resident there are living in rented accommodation. Even though there are areas of big affluence, there are also some blue collar areas, the South Docks, for example, Ringsend, and then pockets in Rathmines and Ranelagh. So it's also been a place where people live a transient life. There are very few people who have moved from the country to Dublin who have not spent at least a period of their lives living in a bedsit or in a flat in Rathmines or Ranelagh, even though that complexion of that has begun to change in recent years. And as you said, the turnout is one of the lowest in the country, which is surprising for an affluent constituency. But that's really down to people who move into the constituency, temporarily live in a flat, who register there, and then after a couple of years move on and register elsewhere, but don't deregister their vote in Dublin 6 or Dublin 4 or indeed in Dublin 2. And their vote remains, even though they themselves no longer stay there and are no longer voting. And just another two other little facts of note are that it has a very high proportion, unsurprisingly, of those who have third level qualifications. And in addition to that, a very high proportion of people who were not born in Ireland. And many of those actually are not entitled to vote in the general election, though they can vote in local elections and European elections if they're European citizens. And we've had this phenomenon in recent years of a lot of new residential property around Docklands, around Googletown, as it's called. And that, you know, has played a little bit into the thinking of parties as they approach this election.
Jennifer, listen to Harry there. One of the things that strikes me about this constituency is that it's a illustration of how terrible our electoral register is and how we need reform in that regard. That, there, as he says, I mean, listen, I have to be honest, I lived for a good portion of my own 20s and 30s at different locations in that constituency. And I don't think I ever registered, maybe I did once, at the various apartments and flats and dingy bedsits, as Harry says, that I lived in over that period of time. And I did vote. I can't quite remember what way it worked. But basically, the system doesn't work, and it doesn't work even more in Dublin Bay South than it does in most constituencies. So it's not actually the fact that people aren't bothering to get out and vote, or at least that's not the main fact. It's that the register doesn't reflect the people who actually live there. The, as Harry says, the up to 50% of people who live in private rented accommodation.
Yeah, absolutely. And similar to you, Hugh, I also had my first flat in Ranelagh, and it was so small that the sink was beside my bed.
Happy memories.
Yeah, and my head touched the ceiling. Yeah, I loved it though. I loved it. So yeah, very familiar with the area myself. And yeah, you're right. There, like Harry pointed out, huge number of people, I think 50% is the figure, in private, some form of private rented accommodation in the constituency. And I think what you find is people who move into those flats, like me, like you, like whoever it is now, and maybe they register to vote, maybe they don't. But if they do register to vote, you know, they move on, because the nature of being in those kind of flats is you don't generally tend to stay there for all too long. You kind of move on to different stages of your life. And those, obviously, that vote is left behind unless you move it on. And it does highlight exactly what you say, the need for this proper electoral register. We're still waiting on the Electoral Commission. Hopefully this is something that we'll see proper movement on this year, because how many years now have we been talking about this, even on this podcast? Since I started here, we've been talking about this. And the thing that strikes me about that is when we talk about the constituency having a low turnout, I mean, I think it had one of the lowest turnouts in the country in 2007 and 2011. You know, who are those voters? Who would you think that they might vote for had they actually stayed in the area? I mean, you would be minded to think that people in the more affluent parts of the constituency who have their set vote would be maybe Fine Gael, and that perhaps the younger voters who are moving around, or as Harry says, you know, a little bit more transient, that perhaps they will be more leaning towards left parties or Sinn Féin. So you'd have to wonder, the turnout obviously will hit everybody, but who will it hit the most? And I would wonder, I'd have questions around that. And, you know, I don't know whether it bolsters Fine Gael's chances or not. I mean, you mentioned there the fact that it's considered like a blue... it's considered a constituency, a stronghold of Fine Gael. And like, I was doing a bit of research into this just to become a total nerd here for a second. And obviously that constituency used to be the Dublin Southeast constituency, well, pretty much all of that constituency. And, you know, Fine Gael effectively has had a seat there for decades, going right back, you know, as far as he can go, basically. And, you know, because you have John A. Costello, Gareth Fitzgerald, effectively holding a seat for the party for decades. And I was tracking kind of through the decades, the percentage of the vote that they had. And throughout Fitzgerald's long time, he always had between 20% and 30% of first preference votes. That holds true throughout the 80s and 90s. Even when two candidates are put on the ticket, they effectively come in at that percentage. It's a blip in 2002. No Fine Gael candidate was returned. And then if you look at, you know, the last couple of years, I mean, in 2020, obviously, we know what happened. We've talked about that before. But I think that's the reason why there's always been a solid vote for Fine Gael in the constituency. Having said that, Harry had a really interesting nugget in his piece where he talked about how, I think, in only three by-elections in the last number of decades, has a sitting government managed to return a candidate. And that puts Fine Gael definitely on the back foot, because that is true. That is very difficult for a government party to do that. And, you know, so I think that's why we're seeing Fine Gael kind of out pounding the pavements all throughout the constituencies, because they know it's theirs to lose. And the difference between now and all the previous elections that I talked about going back decades is Sinn Féin, and the fact that they have risen really to the stage they're at now. Everybody's watching them to see what will happen. So this is just like the last election was, you know, a complete change for Irish politics. You wonder, will that be reflected, I suppose, in this by-election?
And Harry, yes, you've noted as well that James Gagan and Fine Gael are out pounding the pavements already. That with a turnout of, I think you're predicting only about 30% or so, get out the vote is what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, 54% was the turnout in the last general election, so it won't be quite half that. But turnouts for by-elections tend to be traditionally low, so I think it could be as low as 30%. So it will all boil down to the get out the vote campaigns that each of the parties are going to do. Now, so only three of the last 34 by-elections. Noel Tracy won a seat for Fianna Fáil back in 1982 when Fianna Fáil was in government, albeit for a very short period of time. And since then, only three by-elections have gone with government parties. And two of those, Helen McEntee and Gabriel McFadden, won seats after a very close relative had died. And then the third, Patrick Nulty, won after the late Brian Lenehan passed away in 2011, a couple of months after a general election where Labour had its best ever election. I was making the point that if that by-election had taken place a year later, Labour would have been a distant also-ran in that by-election. But having said that, I mean, as by-elections go, I mean, Dublin Bay South is as good a chance for a government party to win a by-election as any other. And Fine Gael think that they should have won Dublin Midwest when Mark Ward won it, but that they weren't sufficiently good at getting out their vote. So that's why you'll see all the senior Fine Gael ministers, all the heavyweights have been out often and widely in the constituency over the past 2 weeks, and will continue to do so until Election Day to try to get out that Fine Gael vote. And on a low turnout, getting out your own vote will become crucial. But then again, Sinn Féin have always been very good at doing that as well. And I'm sure that Ona Brin, who was the person who masterminded the Dublin Midwest by-election, will have a similar plan, or will be involved in a similar plan for Dublin Bay South. And if Lynn Boylan, as is expected, is going to be the candidate, he'll have a double interest in ensuring a success for the party. But it's a big ask for Sinn Féin. I've been spectacularly wrong, and a lot of people, including Sinn Féin, have been spectacularly wrong in terms of how that party is going to do in the past. But it's a big leap for them to go from 16% to get that 50% plus one. And they're going to have to attract transfers from everywhere. And I'm not sure if Sinn Féin are quite there yet in a constituency like this. that they will be capable of mopping up the transfers from other candidates. So the other person, I think, who is hoving into view as a possible opposition person is Ivana Bacic. But now, if Lynn Boylan is in the race, Ivana Bacic's big challenge will be to stay ahead of Lynn Boylan, because if she's eliminated before Lynn Boylan, the chances are that James Gagan will win the seat. Whereas if she stays ahead of Lynn Boylan, she could actually win the seat from James Gagan. That's what the thinking is among some party strategists at the moment. I tend to agree with that analysis at this moment in time. But Sinn Féin is unknown. You know, I think people, there's a generation who have grown up who, you know, think that Sinn Féin doesn't carry original sin and have no difficulty in voting for the party. And the party has is beginning to move away from its traditional kind of Republican and working class base to attract votes from middle class areas and middle class constituencies as well. Not in the volumes of some of the more mainstream parties, but it's certainly beginning to gouge at the margins there, certainly. But I still think it's a long shot for Sinn Féin to win the seat. But then again, at the beginning of July, I could be proven to be completely and totally wrong in relation to that. So I think a lot of it is going to depend on transfers and where the transfers are going to go, Hugh. The Green transfer, I don't think Fianna Fáil and the Greens will win the seat. So their transfers will be critical. And I think that the Fianna Fáil transfers will possibly go in bulk to the Fine Gael candidate. And I think Green Party ones will probably disperse a little more. I think some will go to Fine Gael, but some will also possibly go to Labour. And then a lesser amount might go to Sinn Féin. So I think the destination of transfers from the Alterans will be very interesting to parse and to analyse. So even though the government hasn't won many by-elections, I think, you know, this constituency does provide an opportunity for a government party to actually win if they follow the right strategy and follow the right kind of get out the vote type of campaign.
So part of that strategy, Jen, is, I mean, Fine Gael themselves have very much been portraying this as a Fine Gael versus Sinn Féin contest. And my grand unifying theories of Irish politics is that those two parties do have a mutual interest in the moment at framing political debate in that way, because they both stand to gain from it electorally by coalescing the centre-right and centre-left constituencies around them. But particularly in this constituency, doesn't it kind of suit Fine Gael to have Sinn Féin coming second? Because Sinn Féin are much less likely to overtake James Gagan of Fine Gael in the long run as the transfers go out than, say, for example, a centre-left candidate, be they from the Greens or, as Harry says, seems to think it more likely from Labour.
Yes, it suits them to, not only suits them to have the sequence, as you describe, but it also suits them to have the narrative that it's a Fine Gael, Sinn Féin contest, and that if they just work a little bit harder in Fine Gael this time, they won't have what happened, like Harry mentioned, with Eoin Óibrín and Mark Ward, which is basically them saying to their voters, you know, get out and vote and don't think that this thing is in the bag. And it suits them to kind of present that as a two-way contest. But of course, that might not necessarily be so. And, you know, you mentioned their transfers. I went through last night, because that's the kind of exciting life that I lead, transfers from 2020, just to see kind of what the patterns were. And Sinn Féin, where did they get their transfers from 2020? So Chris Andrews got massive boost from both People Before Profit and the Sock Dems. Those candidates were eliminated. On the final count, also got a good chunk of votes from Kevin Humphreys in Labour, who actually was very transfer friendly to everybody, but particularly Fine Gael. And I think it tells me there's a strong kind of left transfer pattern in the constituency. And like, if you look at where Sinn Féin are popular in the constituency at the moment, I think Chris Andrews probably has a good base around Ringsend, probably a good base around the South Inner City, Sandymount parts of the constituency. And what I think you'll find actually is when the votes come in, that they will have spread that base further out into the constituency. And the question is, how far? And, you know, it's such an interesting one. A little nugget that I came across last night was when Andrews was elected 2020, he put out a tweet where he talked about, he said basically that 100 years previously, 1918, the constituency had elected a unionist, talking about, in his mind, how much it had changed. And I think after doing a bit of digging, I think he was talking about Maurice Stockwell. But anyway, that's just a little interesting nugget for you. Just shows you, I suppose, how the constituency has changed, though I know we're going quite far back now. But yeah, the transfers are so interesting to me. And like I was looking then as well at, you know, the Labour Party. Obviously, the Ivana Bacik is the candidate. She's very well known. I mean, she's an academic, huge national profile, campaigned on social issues, you know, abortion rights, equality issues, you name it. And she's campaigned on it. And it gives her, I think, a very strong starting ground in that constituency, which has been known to be very socially liberal, had one of the highest, I think, if not the highest votes, yes, in the Repeal the Eighth campaign. And like for the Labour Party, I think Harry described Ivana Bacik as being the dark horse. And I would agree with that because of all those issues that I've mentioned, but also because that constituency has had such a strong Labour vote previously. I'm thinking of Rory Quinn, who was TD all the way from 1982 to his retirement in 2016. And the question is that Labour vote still there? I mean, it's tied to the fortunes of the party because in 2011, they took two seats, Rory Quinn and Kevin Humphreys. And between Fine Gael and Labour at the time, they took 60% of all the first preference votes. And then, of course, we know things really took a turn for Labour. And once again, looking at the transfers for Labour, in 2020, Eamon Ryan obviously came, you know, elected in the first count. His surplus, where did that go? It was Labour who did really well out of the Green surplus. And they can expect transfers too from the Soc Dems, from PPP. So, you know, I think that's really interesting to see the interplay between the different parties.
Can I express a note of scepticism on that?
Yeah.
And it's as follows. You're right that there is a Labour tradition in that constituency, as is the case in other constituencies where the Labour's vote has more or less disappeared in more recent years. Ivana Bacik has a national profile. She's very well known. You hear her, see her a lot on the airwaves. She's a respected academic and an activist, as you say. But she's failed before as an electoral candidate in two other constituencies already, and that has to count for something. And the fact is that Kevin Humphreys did have a geographical support base within the constituency, I think also towards that Docklands, Ringsend end of it. So does Ivana Bacik have that kind of boots on the ground kind of support that would allow her to get into that crucial second place or get her nose ahead of Sinn Féin? That seems a stretch to me. It's a big jump from where Labour were at the last election.
Oh, it's a massive jump. And, you know, I'm not saying that she'll do it, but I'm saying that she, I think, has perhaps a better chance than people think. But you're right. Like, if you look at Kevin Humphreys, you know, he had a very strong base, again, around the Ringsend area. I went out canvassing with Kevin before and, like, he knew every single person who passed by name. He had that knowledge, you know, of every home. He could tell me everything about everybody in the area. And no, I don't think that she has that level of knowledge, but I think the party is throwing everything they have behind her. And I think they think she has a better chance than perhaps commentators are giving her credit for, because like Fine Gael, like you said, are presenting this as Fine Gael versus Sinn Féin. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me, I'm saying, if she did better than perhaps people were saying. And like I said, just from going through those transfers, they'd be extremely transfer friendly, I think.
Harry, can I ask you, most of the parties have declared their candidates yet. And I, as you said earlier, I think Cormac O'Quinn reports in today's newspaper, it seems extremely likely now that Lynn Boylan will be the Sinn Féin candidate. The thing we haven't discussed, and you've already ruled out, is the fact that Eamon Ryan topped the poll at the last general election. And there seems to be no expectation that the Greens can perform at anywhere close to that level now. I suppose the first question is they haven't nominated their candidate yet. There's going to be a decision made by before the weekend. How important is the candidate they name? And are they completely out of the race? And is that also what would benefit Bacik? Because it's the same centre-left vote, really.
I think the short answer to that is yes. Actually, Bacik does have a base in the constituency. She lives in Portobello and her mother lives in Terenure. So she has a stronger connection to this constituency than Dublin Central or Dún Laoghaire, where she has contested elections before. She actually did very well in Dún Laoghaire But the party, for one reason or another, decided not to continue with her as a candidate in that constituency. So she is well embedded in the constituency, albeit on the other side to Kevin Humphreys. Just in relation to the Greens, yeah, the Greens is very interesting. The civil war that seemed to beset the party over the past year seems to have died down a bit. And I think the contest in Dublin Bay South is a contest between who's going to become the putative successor to Eamon Ryan when he eventually decides to step down from the Dáil. And the two candidates are very strong. Hazel Chew, very high profile Mayor of Dublin, and Claire Byrne, a former advisor to Eamon Ryan, but who has been a councillor in the South Inner City for some time now and is also very well known within the constituency. It has a strong organisation. I don't think it's going to reach the heights that it did in 2020, where Ryan got 22.4% of the vote and topped the poll. He got elected on the first count. Hazel Chew, of course, and Byrne did amazingly in the 2019 local elections. But the tide has gone out a little bit. You know, I was making the point in the piece I wrote a few weeks ago that going into government is like buying a new car. You know, once you drive out of the showroom, you immediately lose a couple of grand of value. And even though both of the Green potential nominees are saying that they're in it to win, I just think it would be a bit of a stretch. It's likely, well, it's not 100% likely, but Claire Byrne looks like the candidate who might emerge out of that contest, according to Green people locally. And it's interesting for Fianna Fáil as well. Fianna Fáil have always had a seat, well, not always, but there's always been a at least one Fianna Fáil seat in the constituency. The running Deirdre Conroy, who's an interesting person. She has a very interesting backstory. She's a barrister and she's also an architectural historian. She did relatively well in 2019. She ran in a neighbouring constituency in the general election. But I think what Fianna Fáil are doing is just trying to maintain or consolidate its vote. It's had some very weird campaign videos that it has put out.
Yeah, tell us about those.
Well, they've just been on the wrong side of corny. I think I'd invite listeners to go and look at them themselves. I'm not going to try to even attempt to describe what they're like. But they involve a lot of very respectable TDs doing stuff that they would not normally do in their lives and looking a little bit foolish as a result. But I think it's maybe Fianna Fáil experimenting, just trying, perhaps there's a canvasser at the door there because the dog is barking in the background there. But perhaps they're trying to experiment and try to see new ways in which they can campaign. They've got lots of hits on the basis of it. But unfortunately, I don't think they're going to be anywhere near the final line when the votes are counted. So I think Fianna Fáil and the Greens, I think, will not win. But their transfers will be crucial in determining the outcome of this by-election.
I think we now know that Harry's dog is a Fianna Fáil supporter, given that reaction to what he was saying about them there. I do think, Jen, that Fianna Fáil's TikTok strategy is still in its infancy, judging by what I've seen so far.
I think that's really too kind of you, Hugh. No, like in all seriousness, what are they thinking? Those videos and... they're just so bad, you know, they're bloody awful. And it's not even, you know, sometimes parties do this thing where they're like, it's so bad, it's good. Everyone's talking about it. No, everyone's cringing their hearts out, hoping to God they don't do another one. And like, in fairness, like what harm, say you, but if you're trying to appeal to younger voters who are swinging Sinn Féin for a whole variety of reasons, I think they're just going to laugh at you and move on. But that's my take on that anyway.
Can I ask you another thing? It just strikes me, I think it's probably unprecedented in Irish by-elections, is that the gender makeup of the field, certainly of the front runners, is interesting. The front runner is a male barrister. We've remarked already that he comes from a very long line of Fine Gael Blue Bloods and Legal Eagles. There's no shortage of barristers and lawyers from the other parties. There's a lot of political activists, young or youngish women, running in this election, who offer, to my mind, quite a refreshing set of options. You know, there's quite a few of them I'd quite like to see in the Dáil.
Absolutely, and I agree. And I think it's actually it's brilliant to see so many really, really strong female candidates. And you're right, there's a lot of barristers, you know, and there's always this, you know, this sort of idea of Dublin Bay South being very affluent. And yes, there are parts of it that are, but there are parts of it that aren't as well. But when you see all these barristers, it sort of does add credence to that theory. But the thing that strikes me is that a lot of the candidates are very kind of socially liberal. Like, let's look at the Sock Dems. I think they are probably going to run Sarah Dirk. And you know, she was lead organiser in the Waking the Feminists campaign. I mean, look at Ivana Bacik. We've already mentioned her kind of credentials and her history in terms of canvassing. Same for Hazel Chu. She's on the board of Hollistry. You know, very outspoken in terms of maternity care, in terms of, you know, providing that for proper maternity care for women. Same for Claire Byrne. I think really a lot of the candidates display those credentials. And if I could just go back to a point that Harry made about Fianna Fáil, you know, they've got Deirdre Conroy. She took that case in relation to the availability of termination care in the case of fatal fetal abnormality, you know, Miss D in that landmark case. All really strong credentials. And the thing about Fianna Fáil is they have this candidate who has that strong track record, but obviously what works against her is that she's quite new to the game, really, and that probably will run against her. One comment that struck with me at the very beginning of this, I think in the day after Owen Murphy resigned, was Micheál Martin, when he was asked about the by-election. He said, well, you know, it's not always the case that you put your by-election candidate forward to win it. You might be thinking, we'll put your candidate forward and they'll have a good chance of winning the following general election. So it's not all about winning. And then kind of very quickly clarified, I'm not saying that I don't think we can win this, I'm just saying. But it was very telling comment, I think, that he made. And people interpreted it that way as well, that there isn't a great expectation that Fianna Fáil will do well at all. And you can't escape the issue of polling, where the party is at the polls. I mean, they'd love to tell you that they don't pay attention, but of course they do. Of course they do.
Just in relation to Lynn Boylan, she has a proven track record in relation to climate change as well, and that might make her attractive as a person who might take green transfers should she stay ahead of the green candidate. I think she might be slightly vulnerable as well in terms of her location. I think she has been building up a base in Dublin Southwest. And she'll have to explain, you know, to which constituency she is going to give fealty. I mean, if she's elected in this election in Dublin Bay South, is she going to stay in Dublin Bay South?
Harry, can I ask you about geography and how it works in Dublin constituencies? And maybe I'm just head in the clouds or naive about this. Does it really matter at toss to a voter in Tarran Uair if somebody lives in Rathfarnham or something? Is the, you know, is the hatred, the clan hatred between those two suburbs, does it run so deep that one wouldn't vote for the other? It seems a bit unlikely to me.
Well, I mean, in the early days of the state, we had a situation much as they have had in England, where you have they had MPs who lived in London and lived their whole lives in London, who were representing far flung constituencies in the northeast of England if they were Labour. And in the Shires, if they were Conservative, we had a lot of that in the early days of the state, where we had Dublin-based TDs who were representing Clare, Roscommon, various constituencies in Tipperary and Kilkenny. But that has changed a lot in recent years. It's less of a phenomenon in Dublin than it is down the country. But voters don't tend to like the fact that TDs are commuting into their home constituencies. But we've seen it. Frances Fitzgerald was Dublin Bay South, and then she moved out to Dublin Midwest while remaining a resident of Dublin Bay South. I remember Pat Carey, when he was a Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin North West, I think was living out in Ashburn in County Meath at the time. So, but I think that people expect the TD wherever they live to be responsive to the constituency. And if somebody is in a constituency for a while, using it as a placemat essentially before moving on to another constituency, that is something that might be taken into consideration by voters. I think voters don't really mind if the person lives in the constituency, but they do want them to be loyal to the constituency and look after the interests of constituents within that constituency. Jan referred earlier to the kind of the issues that will play into this by-election, Hugh. And housing and PUP, I think, will play into it for certain demographic for younger voters, especially those who are renting as opposed to those who own. But I think there will definitely be we talked about the rebound that Pascal Donoghue was referring to at the start. I think there certainly will be some form of a feel-good factor from vaccination. Vaccination has continued apace. And I think those who have been vaccinated will probably consider that that act will play a part in the votes that they cast. And I think that that would probably favour government parties. How big that vaccination bounce will be is very hard to determine. But I do think that will also be a factor in terms of the final outcome of this by-election.
And of course, the older you are, the more likely you are to have been fully vaccinated by the time we get around to the election. It's funny to listen to what you say there, Harry, because I think my own grandfather was a TD for Donegal for 30 years, but he lived in Dublin Bay South, or what is now Dublin Bay South. So I think that bears out that truth to some extent. James Gagan doesn't live in the constituency. He lives a good 5 kilometres away, I think, Jen, somewhere in Dublin Rathdown. But he's a rather implausible candidate to speak on behalf of Generation Rent, which I was rather surprised to hear he was claiming to be, isn't he? He lives in he's got a 750,000 euro house.
Yeah. And this has come up on, he was out with Leo Varadkar in Harbour Park on Sunday, and I had the honour and privilege to work on Sunday on the most beautiful day of the year. It was absolutely fine, not bitter at all. So I went along to watch him canvass for a little while and do a doorstep with himself and Taoiseach, and I asked him about that. You know, you say that you want to be the voice of this generation, that, you know, he went before the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party, I think it was last week, and pleading for their help effectively, asking them anything they could do, come out for a canvas, leaflet drop, anything, everything, will be very grateful, he said. And he said, I believe, during that meeting, that this, how the housing crisis is a generational issue, and that, you know, he wants to be the voice for the people who are locked out effectively. And then it emerged, of course, that he had bought a house, which I think cost around 750,000 euro. Now, I asked him, you know, can you still be that voice for this generation of people who can't afford to rent, let alone buy? And he said that he was very lucky with his wife and very, very lucky to secure that house. And he wanted, effectively what he's saying, he wanted that for everybody else. But I don't think it does the party any favours. Firstly, to have housing is the number one issue, because obviously they're on the back foot. They've been in government for a very long time now. These are their housing policies. But secondly, then, to claim that you will kind of represent these voters, and then this comes out, it obviously doesn't look great. Like, let's call a spade here. The other thing I was wondering about Fine Gael was, you know, we will find out more details this day, but we know that they are reforming the property tax, and that for 33% of people, they will go up at least one band. And for 3% of people, they'll go up more. And it'll be at least 90 to 100 euro for those people who are going to experience a rise. And you would wonder about how that impacts people in that constituency who, you know, we've talked about the disparity between affluent sections and less affluent parts of the constituency. Is it really great timing for them to be announcing increases in property tax bills when they're running in this constituency? And then, like Harry said, the impact of tapering off the PUP on other people in the constituency who may be younger. And it strikes me that in every way, perhaps not every way, that's probably not fair, but in many, many ways, they're going into this thing on the back foot. A couple of gaffes here. And when I say gaffes, I mean G-A-F-F-E, not actual gaffes, to clarify. But yeah, it does strike me that they're kind of going into this on the back foot, and you'd wonder what will happen or how this will work against them in relation to their budget announcements, their economic announcements.
Okay, briefly, Harry, let's look at the numbers that the parties need to get to in order to be winners. What do Fine Gael need to get in terms of first preference votes to think that they're in the driving seat?
Yeah, they had about 27% after the last election. Sorry about the dog, as discovered another canvas coming in. They had about 27% after the last general election. That will clearly not be enough. So they will need to be in the low 30s to mid 30s at the very least, and then rely on transfers from their government partners, because they're not going to get many transfers from the opposition. I think similarly for Sinn Féin, if Sinn Féin has any hope of winning the seat, it would also need to be up around 30%. Kevin Humphreys, I think, got about 7.9 or 8% in the 2020 election. He will need... or Labour will need to be, you know, multiples of that. They need to be up over 25%. I think they will probably be more transfer friendly than other parties. So they might be able to kind of come back in with a slightly lower first preference vote and still steal the seat at the end. For the Greens would need to improve on Eamon Ryan's 22%. And I just really can't see that happening at the moment just because they're in government. And Fianna Fáil would essentially need to double or more the vote that Jim O'Callaghan got in 2020. And I just don't really see that happening either. But as I said at the start, I have been spectacularly wrong before, Hugh, and I could be spectacularly wrong again. And if I am, I'm sure social media will remind me about it every single day of the week.
Oh, yeah, I'll remind you about it as well. Don't worry about that. But Jen, what do you think?
What do I think? You don't want me to make a prediction now, do you? Tell me you don't want me to make a prediction.
Can you make a prediction, please?
No, absolutely not. Same as Harry. I tell you what, I'll make you this promise. I will make a prediction when the campaign has actually started and the posters are up and the writ has been moved and I've had time to delve into even more nerdy facts. I promise you I will, but just not today.
And of course, we don't even know the exact date. What's the likely date? What are people in the know saying about the date?
I think July 8th, somewhere around then.
Yeah, early July, certainly. And 8th of July. It looks like it's the most likely date as of now.
And a last question, because this is the first election that will take place during or in the immediate aftermath of a pandemic. Will that have any effect upon the way in which both canvassing takes place and the election itself is held?
Yes, it will. I mean, they're not. None of the candidates are canvassing at the moment, and if they do, they'll be chased from the doors. So what they're doing is that they're leafleting. They're using social media, and as Jen discovered last Sunday, they're going to the sunniest parks with the mostest people to not to press the flesh, but to do distant kind of waves and let people know that they're there. So it's going to be strange in terms of that. And that's why some commentators have said that profile of candidates, which is always important anyway, going into the elections will probably be particularly crucial in this election, given the fact that candidates won't have as much an opportunity to meet constituents face to face.
All right, and any canvasser is brave enough to go to Harry McGee's house, know to watch out for his dog at this stage as well. So we shall leave it there. It's going to be very interesting. So it's about a month to go to that election and we'll cover it all the way. Thanks to Harry and to Jen and to our producer, Jennifer Ryan, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We'll be back very soon indeed. Do remember, though, that you can mail us with your thoughts and your questions at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, thanks very much for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.